Welcome one and all. Some people I haven't met, some people I haven't met in a long time, some people I met recently. One and all. We come to Zen practice, any kind of spiritual practice, looking for something, looking for answers, for peace, to understand ourselves more clearly. And sometimes we get some answers. But in this Zen path, it seems to me like the more we practice, the less any particular answer makes sense. Anything that we get a hold of and think we got it actually slips away, or the next year we realize how silly that answer was, and it seems to keep going that way. Of course, we can talk about various things that are helpful, but in the end, it's hard to say what this is all about. Maybe more and more as time goes along, and yet we continue. So today we have a story about this. Case number 20 in the Book of Serenity, called Ditsang's Intimacy. Ditsang is the name of one of the ancient Chinese Zen ancestors. His name means Earth Treasury, because he lived at the Earth Treasury Monastery. We say, in Japanese, we say Jizo, the Bodhisattva, Earth Treasury. And it's about Ditsang and Fayen. Fayen is Dharma Eye. So, in this version, it doesn't explain what the setting of the story, but in the record of Fayen, the story was that Fayen and a couple of his friends were traveling around China visiting Zen temples on a kind of pilgrimage. And but maybe it wasn't so clear exactly where they were going. They were just on the trail. Maybe they hear rumors along the way of, there's a good mountain practice place over there. You should check out the teacher on that mountain. He has some interesting things. And then when they're on that mountain, they hear rumors of another mountain, so they go there. I think even in, I know living at places like Tassajara, there would be lots of people traveling between different practice places and spreading the word on, well, this place is kind of like that, and I wouldn't bother with that place, but maybe check that one out. And in Japan, that was the case too. The monastery I practiced, there were a lot of Westerners on the kind of Zen pilgrim route, checking out different teachers and places. So maybe it was like that in the old days. And Fai Yan and his friends were wandering around, and the snowstorm came and got too heavy to travel any further. So it kind of sounded like they weren't planning to stop at Ditsang's place, but maybe the trail got too deep, and that was the next temple along the road. So they stopped in. Life is often like this, I think, that later it turns out that Fai Yan ended up practicing with Ditsang and becoming his Dharma heir. But it was quite unintentional when he happened to stop at this temple due to the snowstorm. So they stopped in there, and Ditsang, the abbot, asked Fai Yan, one of the travelers, where are you going? Maybe this was over dinner or something. Where are you going on this pilgrimage? And Fai Yan said, I'm just going around on pilgrimage, foot traveling. In Japanese, angya means going by foot, and that was the name for pilgrimages because they walked around from place to place. But there's another way to translate this. The whole phrase here is wandering randomly. I'm wandering randomly, or I'm meandering aimlessly. I'm walking around aimlessly. And Ditsang says, well, what's the purpose of that? Or what's the meaning of that? Or what is the matter of walking around aimlessly like this? What is this business of walking around like that? And Fai Yan said, I don't know. And Ditsang said, not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is most intimate. And one version says, at those words, Fai Yan had a great realization. So it sounds like he was already kind of not so sure in the first place what he was doing, especially if we translate it as he is wandering around randomly or aimlessly. So he maybe already had some sense that he didn't know what the purpose of that was, but when he said, I don't know the purpose of this, the meaning of this, what this actually even is, Ditsang confirmed this, or praised this not knowing by saying, not knowing is most intimate. It often seems like the practice is like trying to know more what's going on here. So we try to learn various teachings of the Buddha. There's so many, right? We can learn more and more and know more and more, understand more and more. But that's not quite as intimate as not knowing. The thing about knowing is that knowing always involves me knowing something, or it involves the mind getting a hold of some object of knowledge. That's what knowing is, right? So in Buddha Dharma and in Zen in particular, there's there's still a problem when the mind grasps an object. That's the fundamental split in our experience. Self and other, mind and object, this and that. We start chopping up reality into bits and pieces, and it's necessary, I think, to do this, to live in this world, actually, but we lose some intimacy with reality when we do so. So the story goes on. The extended version of the story in the record of Fa Yen, it's not included in this book, but after the snowstorm ended and the snow melted a little bit on the path, Fa Yen was about to leave, and Ditsan walked him to the gate out to the path to go do some more aimless wandering. And Ditsan said, "Well, while you are here, I heard you say several times that everything is only mind." And so I have a question about this, Ditsan said, and he pointed to a rock on the side of the trail and said, "Is this rock inside or outside your mind?" And Fayan dutifully said, "Well, inside. Everything is mind, right? This rock's inside the mind." And Ditsang said, "Well, how can you carry such a heavy rock around on your pilgrimage inside your mind?" Fayan couldn't answer. So he ended up staying there with Ditsang for a few months. And they talked about Dharma. So that Fayan could clarify his understanding. And one day said, Ditsang said, "Well, really, in the end, if you want to talk about Buddha Dharma, everything embodies it." And at this point, Fayan had an even greater realization. Not knowing is most intimate. Even though we have to know, in order to operate in the world, at least we have to pretend to know something, like what we're doing. Create some impression for ourselves and others that we know what we're doing. I think society kind of almost forces us to do this. "I know who I am and what I'm doing." People who really don't know and are just wandering on aimlessly, our society doesn't like that so much. So, here's who I am. I have these credentials and these titles, and I'm like this, and is that okay? I know who I am, and now you know who I am too, so now we're all set here, right? But meanwhile, the intimacy is crumbling. We often think of intimacy as the opposite, like when I really know who you are and you really know who I am, that's intimacy. I think we often think like that, but this story is implying that true intimacy is when I don't really know who you are and you don't really know who I am, and yet here we are together, intimately together, not really knowing who we are or what's going on here in any kind of graspable way. And we can be like that. We can sit zazen together. There's a to really understand who we are without some, you know, name or word or label or some kind of knowing like that. There is a practice of turning the light around, our light of our awareness that's always directed outwards towards knowing objects. So it's possible to, and possible but very unusual, I think, it's so counterintuitive to turn the awareness back on itself. In other words, to ask, who is this that knows that I am Kokyo and sitting in the Zendo? Who is it that knows that? What is this awareness that seems to know things? As our Zen ancestor Dogen says, think of what doesn't think. Attend to this awareness that's like before thinking. Awareness from which thinking emerges, from which knowing emerges. The one who knows. Who is the one who knows? Well, it's me, right? Well, no, what do you mean by me? That's just a word. That's a knowing. That's a kind of knowing. Who is this really? And looking back, we find there's just this awareness with no source. There's no source of the awareness. And I don't think this is some spectacular mystical event. I think this is just our ordinary awareness as it is when we look back at the source of that, which is so not what we're used to doing. We don't find anything there, and we can't find the edges to this awareness. We can't find boundaries. We can't pinpoint it in any way. We can't really even say what it is. I don't know what it is. And yet, it's vividly apparent. It's the, it's just our basic awareness every moment. And then, in the foreground, there's stuff happening. Like, the sense of Kokyo as a body and mind organism that knows he's in the Zendo talking to people. That's happening, in the knowing mind, in the divided consciousness. But this divided consciousness is rolling along in this big space called, well, it's not called anything. Called not knowing. Called boundless awareness. Called the way. So I have another wonderful Zen story about this not knowing, where one of the Zen ancestors, Jiaozhou, comes to Nanchuan and says, what is the way? The way, the Tao, the reality, the truth. This is what the way means. Nanchuan says, ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary, plain old awareness, just like this. And Jiaozhou says, well then should I try to direct myself toward it? To find this way? Because don't we want to find the way? Should I try to direct myself toward it? And Nanchuan says, if you do, you betray your practice. If you try to direct yourself towards this way that's called ordinary mind, you betray your practice. Jiaozhou says, well then how can I know the way if I don't direct myself? Because don't we want to know the way? And Nanchuan says, the way, or ordinary mind, is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. So this is a little different than Vitsanga is saying, not knowing is most intimate. This is saying that the intimate way here is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is just illusion, in the sense that that's what, like, you know, chops up the world into bits and pieces, and this painful feeling of separation ensues. That's called knowing, is delusion. And not knowing is this blankness in this case. So Tao Do says, how can I know this ordinary mind way if I don't direct myself in some direction? And Nan Chuan says, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine way of ordinary mind, you will find it as vast and boundless as space. How can this be discussed at the level of affirmation and negation? So this very ordinary plain awareness that's just shining forth from, not from anywhere, it's just shining forth. Each of us is this awareness shining forth. It's not a matter of knowing or not knowing, and it's like boundless space. It has no edges or boundaries. It's even to say it's big mind is kind of too limited. And it's, I think it's very sweet that in the Zen language we call this ordinary mind, because it's not really special at all. It's just that we almost never pay attention to it. We're basically I was talking to somebody today who brought up a nice point. He said, we're biologically and societally conditioned to attend to objects. That's nice, because biologically we're wired as sentient beings to, you know, look for food and mates and so on, something outside us to survive. The object relators are the species that survived. So it's sort of an illusory thing our mind does, but we're biologically conditioned to relate outward to objects, and we're societally related. It's kind of like nature and nurture. Almost like we already got it going biologically, but then society just reinforces it. You need to do this and that, and you need to, like, succeed, and you need to be something and do something with your life. Don't just wander around aimlessly, and so on and so on. Come on, you're living in a world of objects after all. You know, almost nobody in society, except some of these Zen people, say, actually, you can also turn the light around and attend to a non-object. Maybe the only non-object in the entire universe is the awareness of objects. And so I don't know if you have, you know, maybe some people are like, this, yeah, of course. It's just this awareness that's aware of objects is the way. And then, but I'm not sure if we, recently I was talking to somebody who'd been practicing Zen for decades and talking about this. And maybe I wasn't talking about it skillfully, so I'm willing to take the blame. Because it's hard to talk about something actually that can't be talked about. But this, I'm like, so do you have some sense of that? And they're like, no, I don't know what you're talking about, actually. And then this is like communication, right? How do we communicate? It's like, well, it's something so clear. Sometimes they say the heart, that it's so hard to see because it's closer to us than our very eyes. It's our ordinary awareness. And so, I don't know. Anybody, this is like, feel, seem strange? Or did anybody not kind of get this? It's I think very simple, but it's difficult only because it's so unusual to not attend to an object. We're looking for something that can't be like found or grasped, and yet it's like presently here. It's not hidden in the least. It's nothing secret or hidden, and yet it's a different way of being when we're kind of like attending. You could say this part of the mind that attends to things is that now it's like the mind is attending to itself, and at the same time it can be also attending to objects. I think it's easier when we're quiet, so that we do this in zazen. But if the objects get too dynamic, it's almost impossible to not just, that's getting caught up in things, right? So, but if the objects are just, well, there's just some visual things passing through, some sounds passing through, maybe it's a little bit easier to, at the same time that those things are happening. Because as the story says, not knowing is not a blankness. Or not knowing is a blankness, but this kind of ordinary mind is not a blankness. It's not a matter of knowing or not knowing. It's the middle way, which is not knowing or not knowing. But sometimes it's called not knowing, to point out that it's not knowing, which is what we're used to doing. And you could say, so what's the point of this, you know, of this strange thing of like attending to awareness? So, briefly, I would just say that the, practically speaking, in the world of like meaning and purpose and so on, the Buddha Dharma is about relieving suffering. And this is one of like the direct ways in Zen to approach this. And I think it's okay to say that this ordinary mind, this spacious awareness that is who we are right now, all of us, unhidden but not really attended to, this awareness cannot suffer. That's the practical function of this. This awareness, it's impossible for it to suffer in any way. And that's like a big statement, right? It's who we already are. I mean, it's already happening. And it's not suffering. Like our true spacious awareness, boundary awareness, has no problem with anything. Never had one, never will. Even through birth and death, nothing can disturb it. And yet, our suffering, we're suffering. I'm suffering. I have problems. That stuff's happening in the foreground, right? And we're attending to our problems in the foreground. And we suffer. But there's the awareness of the problem that's just like, ah, there's just a problem there. There's great suffering, or there's great joy, there's great neutrality, there's great boredom, there's all kinds of stuff happening, there's nothing happening. It's just aware, and it can't grasp those things because it doesn't know how. It's just awareness. Yes, Richard.
So this awareness is just noticing but not acting, so it would not have compassion?
That's a nice question, which we often talk about here. And so my understanding, experientially, actually, and experientially and scripturally, is that this awareness is naturally compassionate in an uncontrived way. And we could say, well, how is that? Sounds kind of mystical or magical. But I would say, no, not really. It's just that because this awareness has no sense of separation and doesn't grasp anything, and it's aware, I think part of it's naturally aware that this is the case for all of us. So we all are this awareness, and when we kind of meet in that way, there's compassion. And compassion in this case is not a knowing kind of compassion, that like, that person's hurting, I have to help them, I have to figure out how to do it, what are the ways. Not that, but more just like compassion as openness and resonance with all life, and the sense that because I know how this works in this being, our kind of, as I'm more and more aware of how there is this awareness here that's not suffering, it's like the ultimate refuge. I think we can call it Buddha. I take refuge in Buddha. This is how I would understand taking refuge in Buddha. Most bottom line way. I take refuge in ordinary awareness that is completely free from suffering and is completely open to all others, because it sees we're all in the same predicament, that we're all like outwardly directed towards objects, so we're all suffering. It's this is hair's breadth deviation, right? If we just rest back in the awareness, at the same time, it doesn't eliminate the problems in the foreground, but the background never suffers. And it's kind of like who we really are. So when we see that we're all caught in this illusion of the foreground, and yet we all have this immediate potential to rest in the background because it's totally ordinary. It's just, most people never even, it doesn't dawn on us, even though it's right here. So I think that's where compassion is born, is we see what a strange situation we're biologically and societally conditioned to only relate to outer objects. It never occurs to us to learn the backward step, turning the light around to this sourceless source. So therefore I would say it is compassionate, but not like it's some being that has like some, you know, thing called compassion. Yes. Oh, well, let's see, Kathy.
Yeah, if I could now.
Yeah.
I think that is a really beautiful response, Kathy, that you just gave.
About compassion?
Yeah, I really do. And I think that there's a couple of hints that validate that in the very stories. And I think one of them is the pointing out that not knowing, that it's not blankness.
Yep.
You know, and I think that because we're so object-oriented, it's so easy to think, well, if it's not my grasping the object, then it must be this blank,
nothingness,
neutral thing.
Yeah, or stop thinking or something.
But mm-hmm. The other teaching here is it's intimacy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's intimacy, right? And when, maybe especially when we're not caught up in grasping our story, we feel, and that's the compassion. We can actually feel what's there because we're not caught up in our little story. We're actually feeling who's there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's not blank and it's not neutral. Though it is non-reactive.
Yep, it's non-reactive.
You know? And so it is kind of a difficult thing to hold in a way, but...
And I would call this the middle way, because it's non-reactive, but there's a reactive one in the foreground still reacting. So it doesn't eliminate the reactive one, and it doesn't fall into blankness either. But when we're attending more to the non-reactive one, then the reactive one starts to maybe shift a little bit.
Well, and it can.
Yeah, it can.
It can drop away. That's liberation.
Yeah, we could say that just a moment of noticing and kind of confirming this ordinary mind is also liberation. But then that's almost like the ultimate truth. And then there's the conventional truth of the appearances of reaction that are like, manifesting miraculously, really, from, I mean, these are just ways of talking, but it's kind of like from this ordinary mind, like vast space, is like just open sky, but then it the like moisture particles in the sky start to like condense into like water particles, and the water particles come together and you have a cloud, but it's made out of sky, but now it's a big dark storm cloud and lightning and thunder start happening, but it's part of the sky. And it's like, so this is, I think, the middle way that doesn't fall into, the cloud is really a solid cloud that must be destroyed, and it doesn't fall into, this sky can't have any clouds, that kind of blankness. Clouds can manifest, but the more we're attending to the sky that they're manifesting in, the clouds can start to shift. And we could say that the full liberation in the conventional world is when then the clouds start responding appropriately, in accord with the sky. Something like that.
Something like that. Maybe.
Maybe. Not knowing is most intimate.
A Rayrin,
yes. Hi, Rayrin.
Experience is that when I'm in that state where I'm not thinking, especially in an emergency situation, for instance, I cannot think because it's too fast, I will automatically respond rather than react. My experience is always compassionate. That I do the right thing, and afterwards I say, how did I do that? It's really quite amazing.
Yeah, our conceptual thinking often gets in the way, which is not the totally disconceptual thinking, because we need it, right? But it's kind of like, we could say to reify the conceptual thinking is where we really get into trouble. And I'm doing that constantly. But I have some sense that like it's not in accord with reality. So I have to constantly remember and trust the sky. Mm-hmm. So I think the point also about this sequel to the story that we heard about Dietzan saying, well, you always say everything's only mine. Well, how are you going to... And you say this rock is in your mind, how are you going to carry it around? I think this is also like a middle way pointing. Because really when we say everything is mine, we don't say it's inside. Because actually the mind is not even inside. This mind or awareness, the way, is like vast space. And the space not inside the body or outside the body. It has no location, just like space doesn't really have a location. And awareness is like this. So I think space is a nice metaphor. It has no location, but sometimes these mind-only people like Dietzan say, well, then it's kind of inside. We're relating to it as it's all coming forth from in here. Actually, I would say almost like that's the materialist, almost like brain science view. We start to say it's coming from the brain. Well, the ancient Buddhas never talked about a physical brain as the source of this awareness. What is the source of this awareness? We don't know. But isn't it amazing that this is happening? And I think that's the source of maybe every spiritual tradition, is something about this inconceivable, sourceless source that, the Buddha Dharma tends to talk about mind and awareness, but other traditions might call that very same thing God. Where does that come from? I don't know. So it's not like the stone is in the mind or outside the mind, and like that. So the commentary to this story says, Nan Chuan said, the way is not in knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, and not knowing is blankness, referring to this story we just heard. Now, when people hear it said that not knowing is most intimate and that this is where Fayen was awakened, they immediately go over to just not knowing and not understanding, and they say, well, just this is it. So I think this is referring to a kind of a simple answer. Well, just don't know. I think it's kind of talking about almost like before thought, or you almost have to stop thinking. But they hardly realize, the commentator says, that a phrase of the ancients covers everywhere, like the sky supports everywhere, like the earth. If not knowing is most intimate, then what about the saying of one of the ancestors that says, the one word knowing is the gate of myriad wonders. So he's kind of bringing up, knowing is also the gate of myriad wonders, but sometimes we call it not knowing. We don't want to get stuck in a one-sided not knowing. He goes on to say, just affirm totally when affirming, but don't settle down in affirmation. Just deny totally when denying, but don't settle down in denial. That's a nice practice instruction, I think. It means you can say like, yes, it's this way, totally, but don't settle down and, or, you know, grasp that. Or like, no, it's not at all. But we don't get stuck in that either.
Subject to change.
Subject to change. Subject to change and subject to space. Mm-hmm. And the commentary goes on, keep to point out this not knowing more. Kind of like we've been talking, an ancestor says, in walking, in sitting, just hold to the moment before thought arises. Look into it and you'll see not seeing. And then put it to one side. So sometimes we hear it like that. Just hold to the moment before thought arises. But personally, when I hear that instruction, I think it gets too tricky. It's kind of like, try to catch the mind just before thought arises. I mean, I think it might work for some people. There's 84,000 Dharma gates. But for me, it becomes a little bit like a game. Then try to catch the mind between thoughts or something. For me, it's more helpful and natural to just, right in the middle of thinking. It's not a matter of between thoughts or before thoughts. Right in the middle of this thought, who is thinking this thought? Doesn't have to stop thinking to do this. It's thinking of what doesn't think. Thinking of not thinking. How do you do that? Dogen says non-thinking or beyond thinking, which is a fancy way of saying just like rest in space. So in walking and in sitting and in everything else we're doing all day long, just be this moment before thought arises, or the moment from which thought arises, we might say. Look into it and you'll see not seeing. That's a nice way to put it. You'll see the mind that's not thinking. It's just awareness. And then put it to one side, because if you get caught in just in that, you can't function. When you direct your effort like this, rest does not interfere with meditation study, and meditation study does not interfere with rest. So that's a nice Zazen instruction too. Or you could say any activity doesn't interfere with rest, and rest doesn't interfere with activity. because in the midst of any activity, it's possible to let this awareness fall back. You know, we've talked about this in myriad ways before. Sometimes we had a whole year where of talking about this as the mirror, exact same thing, just a different metaphor. So then, finally, the verse that celebrates this story by Tiantong Hongzhir says, "Now having investigated fully, it's just like before. Having shed entirely the finest distinctions one reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long. Stop cutting and patching," or another translation is, "stop pruning and grafting." If you're relating to a tree, let the branch be short, let the branch be long. Let it all be just so. Going along with the high, along with the low, it all spontaneously levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the Zen school is used according to circumstances. Roaming the fields and grounds, he goes where his feet takes him. The purpose of 30 years pilgrimage, 30 years of wandering around, clearly he goes against his one pair of eyebrows. So, just the way the Zen ancestors sometimes talk. But clearly he goes against his one pair of eyebrows is like the, sometimes it's said the eyebrows is one of these strange Zen metaphors for like your true self. So it's kind of implying these 30 years of wandering around looking for answers is all been kind of going against our true nature, our true eyebrows. And because, as the first line says, now having investigated to the full, it's just the same as it was before. And so we have many Zen stories like this, like, you know, before starting practice, it seems like mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And then after many years of practice, I really could come to see that mountains really aren't mountains and rivers aren't rivers. But that's a little one-sided. That's a little, little too much emphasis on the ultimate. So the inseparability of the two truths is the middle way. Therefore, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. That mountains and rivers appearing in the foreground as objects, but they're just held in the big space of awareness. Which is different because first mountains, I gotta climb that mountain and I gotta cross that river or I'm a failure. And in the end it's more like these mountains and rivers are appearing in the space of awareness and we can climb them if we want and cross them if we want or not. It's okay. It's just the display of awareness. You have a sense of that, of this ordinary mind. Yes.
I love the way whenever I see people who, practitioners who really feel that they do have that sense of stepping back. That even from that place, then they engage wholeheartedly. You know, and it's just, it feels like it's a beautiful example of how it really is the middle way, it's not one or the other. And then from this place of freedom, there's all this energy it's freed up to actually engage sitting out very enthusiastically. And if you haven't seen many practitioners, there are stories where they do maybe just stay as hermits, but even then, people are coming to visit them.
Yeah.
They're engaging with the animals and they're doing things with food that they're making. Like
it's a dynamic activity. A nice point, yeah. Yeah. It's not at all passive. You could say the spacious awareness itself is passively witnessing, and yet everything that's happening in it can become more and more dynamic because it's not being grasped at least quite as tightly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fear is just a distraction.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, we all have our like habitual things that really pull us into the objective world, and like where, you know, for me sometimes it's like board meetings, right? I totally forget the space. What happened? And then as soon as I leave the meeting, it's like, what happened? I lost it. So then all my ancient twisted karma from beginning this appearance of greed, hate, and delusion born through this appearing body, speech, and mind, I fully avow. And in other words, I got caught again in the object. Now, I've kind of like admitted that. Now I take refuge in Buddha, the big space. Give it another shot. Okay. Thanks for your presence. Big minds and small minds all dancing together. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's spacious sky-like way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delude.